Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June the 16th, 1999, and in Creekside this morning is Jennifer Mickard, Ethics in Cyberspace, number 99-3. Let's listen in.
So the tape can start taping. I'm Jennifer McPritcher. I teach philosophy at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. My area of specialty in philosophy is ethics, and I've recently become interested in technology and ethics. What I'm going to be talking about today is ethics in cyberspace. And I love cyberspace and philosophical discussions of cyberspace because of what cyberspace does with our concepts of what's real and what's not real. I really love anything that sort of pushes people to change the way that they are currently thinking about the world, and I think that cyberspace does this in a very delightful way. Sometimes very irritating way, but it really does push us to think
funny.
I can define cyberspace. Cyberspace.
Earl Madison.
For most people, cyberspace would be the World Wide Web. Basically, what you can do is, this was actually started, in the early 60s, was when the internet actually came into being. And it was started through the defense industry, just in terms of ways for different computers to interact with each other across large geographical spaces. But it has since been adopted by other folks, and many people argue is the last best hope for democracy, for people to actually participate in what's going on. So most people's interaction with the internet has to do either with email, with discussion groups that are on the internet, or with the World Wide Web, where you can access different web pages, and there are chat rooms where you can go in, you can talk with people in real time, but they're across large geographical spaces. So an example of this would be I in Iowa and Charlie in Washington. We could be in the same chat room at the same time talking to each other, but we'd be typing and it would be far cheaper than actually calling each other. We could also meet brand new people who we never knew before. And so often what people do is they enter into these chat rooms based on their interests. So I have German Shepherds, and so for a long time I wasn't in a chat room, but I was on a mailing list it was an international list, where German Shepherd owners across the world, or people who were interested in German Shepherds, were on the list. We would all just talk about our German Shepherds. We would talk about the problems we were having, the training we were going through, any diseases that or symptoms that our dogs might have, food that we were using. So it was a great big community, or what we call the community. So one of the questions I want to talk about is whether or not these what are called communities on the internet really are communities.
This, in a sense, then, is an alternative to just telephoning or conference calling.
Right. I think that conference calling is probably a better way to think about it, because you can get multiple people. But
it's online and it's on a
right. It's
screen.
On a screen, and there are a couple differences. In the chat rooms, you're talking at the same time. So I'm typing in, and as I type in, you're reading it. Mm-hmm. On the discussion lists and on the bulletin boards, it's more like I send my message to a central place, and then that message gets sent out to everybody else who is on the list. And so they will then read the message when they log on. So I could send the message at, say, 2 in the morning, and somebody could log on at 8 in the morning, and they would read it. But it's basically the same thing, that you go through and you read what's going on. So I'm talking about cyber communities, that's what I wanted to start out with. Many people have argued that cyber communities, that the internet gives people a new and better way, or at least a new alternative. Some people argue it's a better alternative to create community. One of the things that happens on the internet is people who don't feel comfortable talking face-to-face, either because they're incredible introverts, because they don't have the physical means to actually get out and talk to other folks, or for some other reason, that these people now have an opportunity to interact in community where they otherwise couldn't. One of the other positive things that's seen about these communities is that they are created based on shared interests, based on commonality. They're not based on random chance. For people who live in big cities, this is what I've tended to see in my classrooms. They see cyber community as being just this bogus thing because couldn't you just go out to a bar, couldn't you just go to a club, and you could meet people who have the same interest, you know, join a reading group at the library. But you talk to folks who are growing up in small towns in Iowa, and you get a very different picture about what the potential is. I had a student in class who brought up the point. He said, look, if you're growing up in a very small community in Iowa, very, very small, and you're a gay man, you're like 16 years old, you're realizing that you're gay, he says, these communities are the only place I had to actually talk with people about what was going on, to feel okay about myself, and to make connections and to feel supported. He didn't feel, and he was probably not too off base, that in his small community that he could find that sort of support network. Other people, there's somebody, Howard Reingold is a big advocate of cyberspace community. He participated in something called The Well, and I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it was based in San Francisco, and again, it was people all over, I believe it was all over the world, who were just sharing their concerns. They got to know each other. It became very personally fulfilling for the people who were in these communities. Even on the German Shepherd list that I was on, you begin to really know, or at least feel like you really know these people. I mean, I have sat in front of my computer screen crying as somebody typed in about the death of their dog. You know, and it's sort of, I mean, you begin to feel an emotional connection with these folks. There have been other times on the German Shepherd list where there was one person who had lost their job. And so everybody who was on the list pooled together to try and get some money to tide them through. Or if somebody's dog needed an operation, I mean, it was that sort of pulling together. So it does have some potential. There are some criticisms at the same time. And can you think of anything that's I'm guessing somebody here probably heard some of the criticisms of cyber community.
I haven't heard them, but I'm just thinking that community has a couple of functions. One is to reinforce like-mindedness, common interests. But I think of the church as a community which at its best exposes us to points of view we wouldn't otherwise find, different interests. And that this wouldn't do that. You know, I mean...
I'm not sure that church community is the best example of that, because my experience as somebody who has not participated in a church is that there are a whole lot of things that you have to believe before you, at least for me, before you feel comfortable in a church community. So there is still some sort of underlying assumption that everybody shares some basic beliefs.
Well, there's church communities and church community, but okay. I mean, yeah. For me, the value of a church is that it takes me places I wouldn't go on my own. In my head. If it broadens me in ways that I wouldn't find on my own. And I think of that as really one of the best things that community can do, is that it takes me outside of myself and exposes me to points of view that I wouldn't otherwise get. And that the way you're describing cyber communities, they narrow down to a kind of affirmation of oneself and one's own interests, rather than a broadening to...
Well, actually, some people argue that cyber communities do more in terms of widening, because instead of, and again, I live in Iowa, instead of just hanging out with people who are pretty much just like yourself and who have been raised in fairly same circumstances, within a cyber community, I've gotten to speak with folks who are from South Africa. I have interacted with people whom I would not typically get to interact with. And there really is, I mean, this is in its most positive situations. People argue that you really get many more new ideas because people are so far away from each other, and you sort of, there's probably some sort of planting analogy that I could use here.
Cross-fertilization.
Cross-fertilization.
When people use the term community, how are they defining it? What do they mean? Is it just a grouping of people with shared interests and to talk to each other? What sense does this mean, community?
Well, I haven't read any definite definitions, but it's not merely the getting together and talking with people. It's the getting together, talking with people, but a sense of support and a sense of commitment to the community. And I think this is fairly consistent in much of the literature that I've read, that there's a sense of stick-to-itness, that if you're part of a community, that you stick with it through the hard times and the easy times. And so there's a real commitment to just maintaining this group, maintaining the support, and not becoming closed-minded and that sort of stuff.
All of this would depend upon an interrelationship among the people involved.
Right.
And you develop a relationship, and that relationship, to me, is community.
Right. And what folks who are advocates of cyber community, who say that cyber community is just like offline community, they said, look, we're not saying that these communities are necessarily any better than offline communities, but you get sucky communities offline, you get sucky communities online, but sometimes you get really good ones, and sometimes, that the media of cyberspace isn't all that important, that it is as possible to have a real and quite meaningful community in cyberspace. Jim?
I agree with David that ideally communities would expose you to diverse voices, but I think we're also aware that a lot of communities are communities precisely because they tend to be homogenous rather than heterodox. The thing I think you could argue for cyber communities is that it's easier if you want to find those alternative voices, and that assumes that you want to find them as opposed to being exposed to them inadvertently, but at least on the web, if you want to go looking for alternative perspectives, there are a lot of places to go, and it doesn't take long to find them. Whereas in real life, if you wanted to get in touch with a biker gang, you do sort of have to put yourself in that bar, or you have to go into a neighborhood you've never been before. Or, if you're exploring your sexual orientation and you're not sure you want to go into a gay bar, it's a lot easier to go into a gay chat room. So, but I do think that it's both of them are probably homogenous. And your point, David, that the church is one that ideally should expose us to diverse views, I think we're kind of a great comment. I think you're right.
See, actually, as I was reading through this stuff this morning, and I was reading about the cyber communities, it reminded me so much of Holden. Because it seems to me that people who come to Holden, I mean, I could just see this as a possible chat room. You know, that you have interests in social justice, Christianity, what? But that people who come here seem to have basic shared interests, and that's what brings us all here, because we're interested in the exchange of ideas, and also the experience. It seems that Holden is very similar to lots of cyber communities insofar as there's a shared interest, and that's what's bringing everybody together.
The thing that seems different to me, and this is why I wanted to, but you know this far better than I do, and I'm interested in you talking about the level of commitment and stick-to-itiveness, because what Holden, after your first few weeks, reveals is just how hard community is to actually do. I mean, I forget who has said it, but the definition of community is the person you find most irritating in the world lives next to you, and when that person moves, the second most irritating person takes their place, and you somehow have to figure out how to deal with it. So, Holden on the surface is all these people shared ideals and stuff, but the day-to-dayness of actually living through community quickly exposes the romanticism of that kind of view of community. And then that's why I'm curious about, I would argue that it maybe, I don't know if authentic community is the right term, because that implies that others are not authentic, but there is some sense of having to learn to deal with both the worst parts of yourself that happen to get exposed in intimate relationship with others, as well as community dynamics. And that's the part that seems missing to me, but I think it may be that because I may also not know cyberspace, but it gives you so many options. You're feeling crappy, you just don't log on. You don't like what somebody says, you log off. You never have to deal with them face to face. If they've got hemorrhoids that week, they may talk about it, but it's a different level of interaction than having to actually work through the nitty-gritty of community.
I agree. And I think that on cyberspace, there are some ways in which it is much easier to just sort of opt out and say, okay, you are really irritated. There are things that that are going on that I simply don't want to participate with anymore. But I would say that the same thing also happens in other places that we actually call community. I mean, there are many times when people say, okay, you're just irritating me, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I've heard that that's going on in the churches right now in terms of trying to come to certain agreements. People say, well, you know, I'm going to take my ball and I'm going home just because I don't want to play here anymore.
But are we now turning, I mean, are we redefining community so that it really just becomes the epitome of individualism? You know, I'll just figure out what my individual desires are, and I'll find groups of people that I like to do that. And if I don't like them, then I'll join the Baptist. And if I don't like them, then I'll check a different chat room.
But people have, on cyberspace, that the people who advocate that there actually is community on cyberspace have said that, sure, you're going to get people who are there and leave, but there are other people who come together for a specific reason, but then find that they want to be with these people. And so what first motivated them is not what keeps them. I went to an all-women's college, and I recall somebody saying in the yearbook that she came to this college in spite of the fact that it was all women, but stayed there because it was all women. So I think many people who argue for cyber communities would say, well, what might motivate you to first join may not be what keeps you there. And I think that many people in cyber communities have as much, if not more, stick-to-it-ness. I mean, with regard to getting through the hard times, part of that, I think, is that in cyberspace, you're forced to write out all of your ideas. And so there's a sense in which you almost must discuss things, that you can't just ignore people or ignore issues, or sometimes it's a lot more difficult to do that if you're actually going to be talking online. So I think, but I don't want to romanticize this, but I think that there are pros and cons on both sides. People have argued that cyber community can be as fulfilling as community anywhere else. Now, granted, it may not be the best place to have community, but probably a high school locker room isn't the best place to have community either. So we probably don't want to idealize it, but what some people have argued is that cyberspace is just not community, and anybody who's spending their time in these chat rooms is just wasting their time, and they're avoiding reality. And I'm not sure that those criticisms are on the mark. It seems that a lot of people do get a lot of really weak stuff in the cyber community. The difference between cyber community and MUDs is that in a cyber community, for the most part, you are sharing, this is where I start to like this because the word really begins to get thrown out in terms of what's real and what's not real. But for a moment, I'm going to pretend as if it's a distinction. Cyber communities, if I participated in a cyber community, I would use the name that I use in my everyday life. I would say that I'm Jennifer, and I would tell the truth about what my dog's names are and where I live and what I look like and all that other sort of stuff. MUDs,
but that's not guaranteed.
Right.
That's not guaranteed. But
relying on the integrity.
That's the assumption. So the assumption in these sorts of situations is that everybody is being honest about who they, I'm going to put these in scare quotes, really are. In the MUDs, there is not such a guarantee. Multi-user dungeons, and actually, let me read just part something here for you. That would be the virtual sex stuff. Okay, MUDs.
This is different. Virtual sex is different than virtuous sex. It can be the same.
It can be the same, but it might not be. Josh is a 23-year-old college graduate who lives in a small studio apartment in Chicago. After 6 months of looking for a job in marketing, the field in which he recently received his college degree, Josh has had to settle for a job working on the computer system that maintains inventory records at a large discount store. He considers this a dead end. When a friend told him about MUDs, he thought the games sounded diverting enough to give them a try. They're sort of like role-playing games, but sort of is an important word there. Let's see. Josh talked the friend into letting him borrow his computer account for one evening and then for another. Within a week, MUDs had become more than a diversion. Josh had stepped into a new life. Now Josh spends as much time on MUDs as he can. He belongs to a class of players who sometimes call themselves internet hobos. They solicit time on computer accounts the way panhandlers go after spare change. In contrast to his life in real life, which he sees as boring and without change, and without prospects, Josh's life inside MUDs seems rich and filled with promise. It has friends, safety, and space. I live in a terrible part of town. I see a rat hole of an apartment. I see a dead-end jobs. I see AIDS. Down here in the MUD, I see friends. I have something to offer. I see safe sex. His job taking inventory has him using computers in ways he finds boring. His programming on MUDs is intellectually challenging. Josh has worked on 3 MUDs, building large, elaborate living quarters in each. And it goes on to talk about the different role-playing that they participate in. So on a MUD, I could go on and I could pretend, and I could take the role of a gallant prince. So I could be somebody completely different. The problem is, as I get to the end of this, some people, not so much a problem, people often participate in this and they feel like they are more real online than they are offline. They believe that, you know, I go to my job and I have to put on a certain persona in order to get along with my coworkers and my boss. So I have to have this certain persona, but when I get online and I play in these MUDs, I can be more of my real self. I find this really interesting, just in terms of playing with the word real. Who am I really? If I feel like the true expression of myself is being able to pretend like I am a gallant prince who goes around rescuing everybody, well, I'm able, I mean, unfortunately, even when I don't get to express this part of myself right now. I don't think as I ride a white steed through the streets, I would get much more than a ticket. But in MUDs, I could do that. I have a friend who I spoke about a couple days ago, and he's really excited about the possibility of virtual reality because he can't wait to be able to put on a costume and envision himself as Madonna. He wants to be able to experiment with that side of himself, who is Madonna, and sort of let that part of his personality out. So one of the really neat things I think about MUDs is just this playing around with how much of this is a game, how much of this is reality, because a lot of people argue that they really feel more truly themselves when they're in these role-playing games. They feel like society has forced them to conform to certain identities offline, but when they're online, they have far more freedom. And the question this author asked, her name is Sherry Turkle, if a patient on the antidepressant medication Prozac tells his therapist he feels more like himself with the drug than without it, what does this do to our standard notions of a real self? When does a medication end and a person begin? Where does real life end and a game begin? Is the real self always the naturally occurring one? Is the real self always the one in the physical world? As more and more real business gets done in cyberspace, could the real self be the one who functions best in that realm? Is the real Tanya the frustrated nanny or the energetic programmer on the MUD? What do you all think of that? Many of my students are actually quite divided on this. Some think that MUDs are really exciting, just like my friend Patrick, where you get to explore different facets of your personality, where you can leave all that emotional baggage behind and explore a different part of who you are, almost like play acting, not almost like play acting, like acting. I mean, I think that, at least from the little stuff that I've read of people who participate in drama or in music or any other art, that it allows them to be somebody different. I always find it striking that lots of very famous actors who are incredible actors they identify themselves as being very shy people. But acting actually lets them to explore different parts of their personality. What do you all think of the idea of MUDs? Are they real? Are they dangerous? Should we encourage folks to explore different sides of their personality, or should we turn them off?
Is this an area within, or is that a specific thing that you plug into? I mean, see, I don't know anything about computers.
You can plug into it. It's one way to think about it might be, this is off the top of my head, might be like thinking of a newspaper. In a newspaper, you can open to the editorial section, and you'll get one type of writing. You can get lots of different opinions. You can look at the front page, where it's all going to be factual stuff. You can go to the comics, you know, so it depends on where you go on the internet, what sort of interactions you will be having. Most people agree, and I say most because not everybody does, that there should be fairly good rules in each of these sections so you know what you're getting into.
But you and get into MUDs.
And you would basically
with
know,
intent.
Right.
And,
yes.
And if you encounter anybody on MUDs, you know that they are coming from the same place you are,
right.
Fantasizing in a sense.
Right. And the example I used in terms of my being some sort of knight is a little bit, it is one example, but there are others that are very mundane.
Yeah.
I could just pretend like I was a 60-year-old man who is a retired electrician. So it doesn't always have to be fantastic.
No, but it's
but
not
yes.
not reality, or not reality in the sense that
it's not offline.
Yeah.
Offline, online. Yeah. Works a lot better when you try not to make a commitment on what's real.
Because
what's
when you get to describing reality, I mean that's another whole philosophical thing. Is that table real, or is what's in my heart real?
Exactly.
And that's
well, and the question of if I go to a conference and I give a paper, is that who I really am? I'm going to be dressed a certain way, I'm going to be acting a certain way, and I would argue that the person I am there is far less real than the person I might be on a discussion list, where I feel far more comfortable.
Well, many of us, I mean, we all experience that in different parts of our life, whether we're with our parents, our
right.
good friends, or in a job situation, in pulpit, whatever, you're a different persona in some ways.
But MUDS is in a way a sort of digression from...
It's far more deliberate, and it actually goes in really well with the gender bending online, because what lots of people have argued with regard to sexism, well, mostly sexism, within and how to battle sexism and using the MUDs, is that lots of people will go into these and they'll pretend to be a different gender, and with some very interesting results. Now, nobody thinks that you can fully experience what it's like to be a different gender, but that this sort of acting can help people to begin to understand. The ratio of men to women online is fairly high. There's something like 3 men for every woman. And so for these role-playing games to be any fun at all, you have to have some men who are pretending to be women. And what they found is that the men who gender bend become more sympathetic to what women go through. Because the men find themselves, as they're playing women, that all of the other men come and ask them constantly if they need help. Do you need help doing this? Have you figured out how to do this? Yes, I know how to do this. And they will make sexual overtures. And if the man says, if the man who's playing a woman says no, well, the men who are playing men don't give up. They continue and continue and continue. So many men who are playing women have said that they've gotten a little bit of insight about what it must be like to be a woman. Interestingly, though, to mess things up completely in the MUDs, is that women tend to pretend as if they're men because they get less harassment. So women will frequently go online, and especially at the very beginnings of it, they'll pretend to be men just to be left alone. So that I think is very interesting, and people have argued will help outside society. Now it's not any sort of solution, but that this sort of if we recognize who we are is to a large extent socially constructed, and if we can go online and start to tweak our personalities and actually walk in somebody else's shoes, we can begin to creatively imagine how other people's lives are, and this can help us offline.
You keep referring to them as games. So if you join a mud and you decide to practice a little gender bending, are the objectives of the game already clearly outlined, or do the participants invent a game? What is the nature of these games? Are they the same with variation, or what's the purpose, what's the goal, what's the...
It's going to depend on the mud. For some of them, there is a specific time limitation, so there is a real goal in terms of some sort of adventure, trying to save something like that. But for other muds, it's a community that's been set up. Trying to think of an example. The only example I can think of is, as a kid, I used to play with those little play school dolls. And you can imagine just sort of having an ongoing story. And you would go back each day and you would play with the characters. And then, so it's this idea that there's a community that's just ongoing that you are a part of. I've never played Dungeons & Dragons, but I have the sense that it's very similar to that, that it can just keep on going. And so it depends on the particular mud. Some are just like futuristic, and you get people who are shopkeepers and people who are the sheriff, and you just have these daily interactions. People go to a cafe and they talk with each other in the cafe, and then they walk outside and they do something else. So there may not be any end goal in terms of the point of the game that's beyond just pretending like you're somebody else. Sort of like a Renaissance fair, maybe, where there's a sort of theme, but there's no goal to the Renaissance fair.
I guess if I were inclined to be very critical, I might say that the danger of this is that it allows people who don't feel like offline they can be malicious, to be malicious online. And that by doing that, you affect their character offline, so that ultimately you can't make this neat distinction between the two. And the real person becomes more malicious with time as they engage in malicious acts online. So that'd be one concern I would have. The other is, I was thinking, originally when you described it, I thought, boy, this sounds very self-indulgent. You know, spending all this time, the world's got all these problems, your community's got all these problems, why aren't you out there doing that instead of sitting in your hovel? But on the other hand, you know, I've been here for almost 2 weeks, and I'm just about through a P.D. James novel, and I intend to start another one as soon as I can. That's diversion, it's entertainment, I enjoy it, I play basketball. Why should I say to someone who enjoys this as diversion, who may be very involved in their community and doing lots of good things, that they can't do this? So, I don't know. I find it also interesting that I've been online since, I don't know, 1992, and I've never been to any of these things.
Oh, really?
Never.
I have a question.
Yes.
I don't know these things. That's just the inkling of it. But I'm wondering, if a person is suffering in depression, would going into something like this maybe help them to become somebody else and bring themselves out of it or something?
People, the sections that I've been reading here have been out of Sherry Turkle's book called Life on Screen. And she's a sociologist, and she actually has a couple chapters in her book where she's talked about how helpful these can be for people who are trying to deal with depression or deal with trauma. The couple examples that I thought were particularly interesting had to do with cyber sex. They were for women who had been sexually assaulted, who did not feel comfortable interacting with anybody. But they were able to slowly become more comfortable trusting people through cyberspace. So I think that what the argument has been is that for at least some people, now it can be taken overboard in the same way that you can become too dependent on drugs, or you can become too dependent on therapy or something like that, but that that participation in cyberspace can be therapeutic, because it It provides safety for the person and allows them in their own time to participate more. So yeah, it does.
I've been a sounding board for two different women that were raped when they were children, and neither one of them is in reality right now. But I was wondering if something like that might, if I don't know if they could work through that for you.
I think that there are risks in cyberspace just as there are risks just about anywhere else. But people have argued that it can be quite therapeutic, just in terms of building self-esteem and stuff like that.
Jen, help me on this, because I haven't read Riley this, but I think I read some feminist critiques that this is sort of just the ultimate male fantasy now, that the sort of maleness has been associated with rationality, the mind. We can leave the bodies, leave the earth behind, and what's of really ultimate value is our minds. And that this, and it's not coincidental that there's a much higher percentage of men who get involved in this than there are women, and that it just it ends up being a way then of just not having to deal with matter, whether it's mother, you know, our bodies or the earth, and some real concerns about that. But have you read any of that kind of critique and some of the stuff that you've done, and how would folks respond to your advocates of it?
Most of the people who would respond would say that the mind is what's essential, and that the body can be left behind and is going to be malleable. I mean, they'll say, well, of course, what my body is does influence me, but this gives me an opportunity to pretend as if I don't have a body, or as if I have a different body. So they would say that it's, while yes, that's true, that it's not horribly problematic.
And I find some concern is that when 2/3 of the world's population, human population, has to focus on bodily needs simply to survive, and when the hidden cost of the earth of our actions are there too. That's one of the things I just, in terms of reshaping our assumptions about what's really real, it does seem to be an affluent luxury to be able to define what's really real apart from physical bodily needs or apart from the earth's rhythms. And then, you know, what does that mean if we move further in those directions? I mean, you've outlined several things where I can see in selective circumstances it can be enormously helpful. But in terms of then leading to a fundamental sort of repositioning about reality and what's really real, you know me well enough to know I'm just a skeptic anytime the earth and physical bodies get left out of reality. I don't want to limit it to that, but I also don't want to have them be simply discarded.
But I don't think that's going to be unique to cyberspace. I mean, because I remember getting very involved in books to the point where I didn't notice anything else that was going on outside of me. And I think after I read Catcher in the Rye, my language ability, I started swearing constantly because there was so much swearing in Catcher in the Rye. So I'm not sure that cyberspace...
No, but this to me seems more like, I don't know whether it's the logical extreme, but it seems to be a perfectly consistent further development of the kind of assumptions that govern sort of industrial society that now moving into more the information age, which increasingly distance ourselves from rhythms of the earth, rhythms of our bodies, and the fact that those of us who are affluent can, by and large, pay little attention to that. I mean, if you were reading Catcher in the Rye and then you had to go out and work in the fields for 3 hours, chances are you would have been brought back to earth in some different way. Catcher in the Rye would have still been a very interesting way for you to get away from that.
I don't think that anybody's arguing that people have to spend all of their time here. So I'm not sure I think that anything that's taken overboard is probably going to have those sorts of problems. And I do think that there are some folks who say, you know, so what? You know, if we ultimately all get plugged in and we spend all of our life online, that's not a big deal. But I think that most people would say that this is something that you shouldn't go overboard on. But I see your point, and I think that there are those sorts of dangers there.
I guess at just some point, you know, I think I don't believe we'll get to the point where we can just simply be ignorant of the Earth's limitations in some sense, whether it's ecological or climatological and stuff, and sort of to end up with versions of reality that don't understand that there are constraints or limits as part of that. For me, it ends up being problematic.
Any other thoughts about the MUDs?
Because
I don't want to go on to or about the gender bending. I mean, some of the other interesting things about MUDs and gender bending, or, and then we move on a little bit to cybersex, is there's an interesting part in her book where she interviews the sixth graders, I think like fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, and they talk about how much they like interacting online with each other because it takes a huge amount of pressure off of them in terms of sexual pressure. That they feel like if they go to dances or parties and stuff like that, there's constant sexual pressure. Whereas online, most of the girls talk about how they feel like they can go much more slowly and that things don't have to progress. They can actually get to know people without being pressured into things. And the boys feel like there is less pressure on them to be making these advances. And so I thought that was interesting. I'm not sure if I want to advocate all kids going online and having cyber sex or anything like that, but I find it very interesting that for young adolescents, that interaction in cyberspace is seen as more safe, and it puts they feel far more in control. I think that's interesting.
I can see why you call it, why you might call it cyber dating or cyber romance, but cyber sex.
Yeah, that's cyber sex.
Although if we get to virtual reality, I suppose it's possible.
Yes, it would be. I mean, and it's probably closer to cyber dating because they might hold hands or they might kiss online. Mm-hmm. They probably, as 12-year-olds, would not venture into sex. Mm-hmm. But I'm incredibly naive when it comes to things like that, so.
Okay.
Well,
there you go, Tim. With these things in general, I don't know which one, but for somebody who is a very flat person, just like to speak up, would these help them develop their personalities perhaps?
I don't think that there's been any conclusive evidence one way or the other. There's lots of anecdotal evidence that for some people it really helps a lot, that they become more confident online and they take that confidence offline. For other people, though, they just get so mired in the online world they can't ever transfer it to the offline world. They feel more comfortable online than offline. But then there's the question of, okay, well, is that really a problem? I feel more comfortable in certain places in my life and not as comfortable in other places in my life. Is it wrong for me to opt to stay in the places where I feel most comfortable? But this is, as Dan is pointing out, most of this stuff is very individually centered. Sort of what's the best thing for me? And there's not a whole lot of discussion, well, it may be best for you to stay online or stay in your room because you can't deal with the outside world, but you might have a responsibility to the larger world that you are not fulfilling. But there have been some arguments and some studies and some anecdotal evidence that it goes both ways, so I don't think it's very conclusive at this point. I do know, I actually just was reading an article, I think, in the New York Times out there, that this doesn't have anything to do with any of these, but that online communication, email, has done a lot, and I actually found this to be true in my family, in terms of parent-child relationships when the children go to college. It wasn't until I got email that my father and I actually started speaking, because, you know, I called the phone, he was busy, and I didn't really have much to say to him and all sort of stuff, and if we did start to talk, we might end up arguing, something like that. But on email, we actually began to communicate a whole lot more because we had the time to write things out. And if I was online at 2 a.m., I could write a letter and send it off to him, and he could, in his spare time, send the letter back to me. And if you look at some of the stuff that's happening in colleges, children are staying far more in touch with their parents because of email. Some people see this as a problem. I recall talking to a colleague whose son had gone somewhere in Europe, and it used to be the case that when you went abroad, you went abroad and you didn't interact with your family. Now you can be sent an email back and forth all the time. So there's this question of, well, but shouldn't people who go off to college, shouldn't they be cut off from their parents? Isn't that part of the college experience? So, I mean, there's some interesting opportunities that are going on, and I guess the push of all of these sessions for me is that these new technologies can be good or can be bad. It depends on how we use them, and that we do need to be very deliberate about how we use them. I want to quickly read, because this is some of the stuff that I find most fun, just because it plays a lot of people's minds, is this cyber sex. This cyber sex is basically the two individuals involved would type out what they're doing or what they would be doing if they were in the same room together. It can get very graphic, and I'm not going to share some of the more graphic stuff. Although I did get one that was sent to me by a friend of mine. It was just hysterical because there was one person who was taking it very, very seriously and trying to make it very romantic and very wonderful and very perfect. But the other person who was typing was making it really real. So it was like, oops, I just kicked over the candle. Your curtains are on fire now. It was great fun to watch this, to read the two of them. What I think is that this brings up some really interesting questions about what counts as sex, what counts as adultery, things like that. Here's some stories about possible adultery. Martin and Beth, both 41, have been married for 19 years and have 4 children. Early in their marriage, Martin regretted not having had more time for sexual experimentation and had an extramarital affair. The affair hurt Beth deeply, and Martin decided he never wanted to do it again. Congratulations, Martin. When Martin discovered MUDs, he was thrilled. I really am monogamous. I'm really not interested in something outside my marriage. But being able to have, you know, a tiny romance is kind of cool. Martin decided to tell Beth about his MUD sex life, and she decided to tell him that she does not mind. Beth has made a conscious decision to consider Martin's sexual relationships on MUDs as more like his reading an erotic novel than like his having a rendezvous in a motel room. For Martin, his online affairs are a way to fill the gaps of his youth, to broaden his sexual experience without endangering his marriage. Other partners of virtual adulterers do not share Beth's accepting attitude. Janet, 24, a secretary at a New York law firm, is very upset by her husband Tim's sex life in cyberspace. After Tim's first online affair, he confessed his virtual infidelity. When Janet objected, Tim told her that he would stop seeing his online mistress. Janet says that she is not sure that he actually did stop. This distressed wife struggles to decide whether her husband is unfaithful when his persona collaborates on writing real-time erotica with another persona in cyberspace. And beyond this, should it make a difference if, unbeknownst to the husband, his cyberspace mistress turns out to be a 19-year-old male college freshman? What if she is an infirm 80-year-old man in a nursing home? Or even more disturbing, what if she is a 12-year-old girl or a 12-year-old boy? Tiny Sex poses the question of what is at the heart of sex and fidelity, and she talks about cyber sex, Tiny Sex. What is at the heart of sex and fidelity? Is it the physical action? Is it the feeling of emotional intimacy with someone other than one primary partner? Is infidelity in the head or in the body? Is it in the desire or in the action? What constitutes the violation of trust? And to what extent and in what ways should it matter who the virtual sexual partner is in the real world? The fact that the physical body has been factored out of the situation makes these issues both subtler and harder to resolve than before. What do you all think? Do you think that having tiny sex or cyber sex is the same? I mean, it's obviously different, but would that be adultery? Would somebody who gave their partner permission to have cyber sex, would they be basically making a decision that would be very similar to saying that they have an open marriage and can go and sleep with anybody they want to? Are these similar? Are they different? Is it pornography or is it a real relationship? What do you all think? I think it's important here to distinguish between deception and people being honest about it. So we'll just take a case where people are actually being honest about it. So it's not that they are deceiving their spouse that's the problem, potential problem. What do y'all think?
The kind of initial response is that it falls along, I think, Dan's thrust about the separation. Seems to me we are in enough trouble as human beings to separate our emotional selves and, you know, from what makes us our total self, physical, mental, emotional, and all of this, and this really breaks off a piece of that. And, the unreality of, that, it seemed to me if you're going to get into a relationship, the investment of the whole self matters. And so to give a part of oneself,
these folks would say that these really aren't relationships. This is just a bunch of one-night stands that don't have any meaning. So there's no pretense that this has meaning. It's the idea, it's just like watching pornography. I can enjoy myself. I can perhaps learn things that will make my partner happier. I'm not doing anything wrong to anybody.
I would see it in terms of, I think the relationship to the partner is one that ought to be total, and this violates the totality of that.
The relationship with your offline partner?
No, to the relationship with to the real life spouse.
And why is that?
Well, because it isn't a commitment of one's whole emotional, physical, spiritual self to this one that it seems to me, at least my understanding of marriage, is that's what I committed myself to with Sandy. Was
do you think if you got online and you had very personal conversations with somebody that were not sexual in nature, but just sharing things about your childhood, things that you may have shared with your spouse, but would that be a violation of your marriage? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I don't see that as a violation of that relationship. There's something about the totality of the sexual, it seems to me the ideal is a kind of a whole package in the sexual relationship. It's assumed that,
But you could have the whole package with your spouse. I could have.
But somehow needing one part of that to be with someone else seems to me to be a violation of the commitment, at least I would try to achieve.
It sounds to me, though, that it's not merely needing something else from somebody else, because I think most people believe that you can't get everything from your spouse. So there are going to be lots of realms where you just can't get everything from your spouse, so you have another friend from whom you get that sort of emotional support. There are things that I can get from my sister in terms of emotional support that I can't imagine getting from anybody else because she lived in the same household I did. So it doesn't sound like it's merely that you're getting something else from somebody else that's not your spouse. It sounds to me, as a guess, that it's the sexual aspect.
Well, Jennifer, let me give you an example too. It might be somewhat parallel. I know some couples where the two partners have very different levels of interest in being sexually active. And they come to mutual agreement that the one partner who just seems to have a much greater desire and need for sexual activity has a fairly active masturbation life, which may or may not be with the other partner present. They also are sexual together, but less frequently. And they seem to be quite fine with that. Now, in my upbringing, the Catholic Church would have frowned on that because masturbation would be seen as neither. But I think a lot of Protestant churches can see talking to their sexuality about masturbation being an integral and a healthy part of both either an individual's life or in a relationship. But masturbation life oftentimes involves fantasy about all sorts of other things. Is that qualitatively different than, say, what we're talking about here in terms of cyber sex?
That's what I thought of immediately, making the analogy between us and
them. And the analogy I thought of was the long the long-distance couple that exchange mail, and that the only difference here is the real-time nature of the communication. But, you know, if you've got a girlfriend in another part of the world and you exchange letters back and forth and there's a lot of fantasy about what you would be doing if you were together, you know, it just takes longer to get those messages. But you build a reality, just like in the mugs, that is feeds off the imagination. There's, you know, Father Culver and these people say the imagination is where it all starts anyway, right?
So. Well, something that keeps bothering me, the Bible says, or at least I understand it to say, if you lust after a woman, you've committed adultery already with her in your heart.
Jesus says it.
So, what's this kind of stuff? Other than saying this is another way to commit adultery.
Well, do you agree? I mean, I would say in my class.
Hate to go up against Jesus.
I'm not sure what to say. But in my classes, what I would say was, well, is Jesus right? Is lusting after somebody else, is being interested in somebody else, is that the same as adultery? It doesn't seem to me, at least among my students, most of my students say, well, you know, it's incredibly unrealistic to believe that you will be in a forever relationship and never be attracted to somebody else. They think that's just, and they say, and so, no, that's not adultery. It's adultery to act on it. Now, yes, I am challenging Jesus, but I'm not sure I want to do that.
Another thing he says is that if you hate somebody, you have committed murder in your heart already, so it's not just that.
But I think another way of looking at it, perhaps, Jennifer, would be that at least the Christian tradition brings a pretty healthy skepticism to our ability to, I mean, you talk about this is just like a one-night stand, but many...
I know.
The argument is there. But many, you know, we're also realistic to know that many long-term affairs began initially as a one-night stand, or things that we often have a lot of unintended consequences. We think we're in control of things. We think we can manage between different relationships. And so if I do something here, it's not going to have ramifications. And I would say more often than not, that ends up being a fairly foolish thing, but we often have learned it only in retrospect when the damage has been done. And so whether you call it original sin, whether you call it temptation, whatever, Christian tradition has a pretty healthy skepticism, and that's one of the reasons why it puts some emphasis on voluntary self-limits as part of our relationships, our commitments to each other, in recognition that, yes, that does mean you might be limiting pleasure, limiting satisfaction, whatever, in particular circumstances, but the understanding for the long-term health of relationship and community and for the individual, that those are really important. And so, again, I come back to, I can see places where, and I think you said this as well, that what it requires is thinking through very carefully when is this positive, potentially positive, and when is it simply the risk too great, and how does anybody decide that?
Well, I want to push you on this notion of limits and talking about limits, because what I have found is a real gender distinction in terms of what is important about sex, what's important about adultery. The men seem to focus this mostly on the physical aspect, whereas the women seem to focus more on the emotional aspect. And so what I find interesting, I mean, I think that I have, this is not my area of specialty, but I would hazard to guess that as many long-term relationships start out of close friendships, where you're talking and sharing deeply personal things with each other, as come out of some sort of one-night sex stand or sexual encounter, and yet
that does vary a lot by both gender and sexuality. Statement.
But it seems to me that we don't talk about what I would want to push is really trying to figure out what is wrong about adultery. Is adultery wrong because of the sex act, or is it because you are sharing something intimate with somebody else? If it's the latter, then that really begins to, at least for me, starts to break apart lots of stuff, because many people who are in long-term committed relationships have very close friends outside of that relationship with whom they share very deeply personal things, and sometimes things that they don't share with their spouse. And for, I think, often very good reasons. But we don't call that adultery. And so what I mean, so what I think that the question of cyber sex does is it really begins to push us on clarifying things, because it does separate out the mind and the body so much, then it becomes, well, which of these really is important? And if let me move on quickly from cyber sex, and I lost my piece of chalk, to cyber rape. What has happened online, and this is, and people who sort of argue, well, this stuff isn't real, it's just sort of fake, it's not that big a deal. All of a sudden you get into a situation where what can happen online, if somebody knows enough about computer programming, they can take control of somebody else's character. And they can force that character to do things that the person who is on the other line doesn't want to be doing. And so there have been cases of what's called cyber rape online. And so then for me, on the one hand, people, cyber sex, that's not really real, that's, it's sort of weird. But then when you merge it into somebody being forced to do something, their persona being forced to do something online that they don't want to be doing, then they think, well, that's just wrong. They're being, that's actual rape, and I don't care if it's online and not offline, and there are no bruises, you have still emotionally done something to that person. So I find, so when you start pushing that sort of stuff, I think it becomes, again, much more muddy. And since I'm a philosopher, I like things that get more and more muddy, because I think they're just far more interesting to think about. And so if I move on from cybersex to this notion of cyber crimes, there's some other things that go on the internet that people have had some serious problems trying to deal with. And these are not cyber crimes in terms of people who are hackers who use the computer to break into the Federal Reserve. These are crimes that happen in the mud. And so it's a question of, is raping someone online, is that wrong? Is that
legally or morally?
Morally. Should that be punished? Should the persona be punished? Some people have argued, and these are people I would not want to ever meet, I don't think, that by being allowed to rape online, being able to commit violent crimes online, that's a very cathartic experience for them. So they can do it online, and now they won't do it offline. That it's basically fantasy for them, and it's healthy fantasy. There's been one highly publicized case about, there was a news group, it was like alt.sex.fantasy, something like that. But it was where people posted highly pornographic, very violent stories. And somebody posted a story, a very violent story, about a woman who was in a class of his. He had never spoken to her, she had never spoken to him. He posted it on this newsgroup. Somebody else happened to see it and told her about it. She would have never known about it. So then the question comes up was, well, should he be punished for what he's done? And if he should be punished, how should he be punished? People who commit cyber rape, they've done something offline, or online. They've done something in cyberspace. So is it fair for crimes that happen on cyberspace to punish somebody in the real world? Or should the punishment only take place in cyberspace? But these are really, I think, interesting questions. I don't have answers to them, but they get real money.
Yeah. I forget which one it is, libel or slander, but it seems to me that we do that now when people do that in the media.
The problem with libel and slander is that there has to be the intent to harm, and it has. But the thing is, he posted this to a private. I mean, it's not private, but it's ostensibly. People don't read it unless they come and they want to read it. And the libel and the slander laws didn't cover this sort of case. So in terms of fictional stuff,
as a generous judge, I would have extended them.
he was not presenting this as the truth. Both libel and slander are going to be relevant laws only if you're claiming that what you're saying is actually true. He wasn't saying this was true, so this is fiction. You're making this up big time.
So it gets to your philosophy of punishment. Is it rehabilitative? Is that the intent of the punishment? Or is it to frighten you from doing it again? You know, kind of.
But then there's even the question of the jurisdiction. You know, who gets to choose?
It's a legal issue.
Where the but we currently don't have laws that cover this. I mean, that's what's fun for me as a philosopher. Is I mean, for me as a philosopher, I don't particularly care what the laws are because laws have historically been woefully misguided. I'm more interested in figuring out, well, what's right and what's wrong. And in these cases, I think it gets very interesting because my gut reaction is, well, this young man, these people who are doing this, this is clearly a portent of what sort of people they're going to be as they get older. Unfortunately, we don't get to punish people for what we think they're going to do in the future. And if somebody has committed a crime in a society, and that's what cyberspace is, maybe we'll talk about these being societies that don't have rules that prohibit this. So if there's no rule that prohibits this sort of action, is it fair to punish people for having done this? I mean, so those are some of the interesting questions you get in terms of playing around with, is this real, is this not real? If you take the position that these are just fantasy games, well then, you know,
so you post a notice and you say, enter at your own risk, this may be psychologically harmful, but we're not creating rules to govern ourselves,
right.
We prefer anarchy and libertarianism. Because it seems to me that you don't have to prefer anarchy and libertarianism, and that if the people that play the game want to create rules, they can. The question is whether you can enforce them.
Right. And what has happened, we're out of time, but what has happened in some of these MUDs is that at the very beginning, they basically had no rules. But it wasn't an intentional no rules. It was just, well, we didn't think of that rule. So we didn't think that we actually needed that.
Sure.
And then people commit crimes, and it's like, oh gosh, what do we do now? What's happened is, what you can do is, you can lock a persona out. So you can say that they can't come back in. That's fairly short term because they can just
create a new persona.
My concern about this is possible carryover into reality.
Sure.
Is this going to make them go ahead and do it in reality?
Well, my concern is that the imagination is reality. It is reality. Mm-hmm. Seems to me that's some of what we do in worship.
But what I'm thinking about is the influence. Some people think that television has a very bad influence on people because they see crimes, or not necessarily crimes, but they see people doing bad things or things that hurt other people, let's put it that way. They see people on television doing things that hurt other people constantly, and so they get used to the idea, well, hurting other people isn't so bad.
That's possibly true, but I think, first of all, that most of this, I mean, they're barely controversial, and there really hasn't been anything settled in terms of what's what. I purposely used the example of cyber rape. I think that has a much more emotional impact. If you talk about people killing each other, I mean, I know that my father and my grandfather before him probably were out playing cowboys and Indians shooting each other, and these were both very gentle men who, to my knowledge, never picked up a gun and aimed it at another human being. So there is a question in terms of how much does this role playing, how much will it affect the outside behavior? And there haven't been any conclusive studies on what the actual consequence is going to be. So I'm not taking a position on what the consequences are going to be. I think it's something to be concerned about. And I am concerned about it just in terms of, well, what sort of person are we creating? Does it have a cathartic effect? Does it not? People have long argued that violent pornography is a good thing because people can have these fantasies, they can get it out of their system so they're not doing this on real women. I don't know what the facts are about that. We need to end because our lunch is about to start. So thank you all. And next time, on Friday, we will be discussing artificial intelligence and artificial life and computers.
And just to plug too, that the forum
tomorrow night
is going to be children and technology. So these kinds of questions about children.
When are you going to say it's just wrong?